Hello and welcome to Millennial 2018, and this is the final one for tonight, and this is with Demarcus Leibowitz. Some of you, I think most of you, will have heard of Demarcus. Would you like to introduce yourself, and welcome to Millennial, Demarcus?
Oh, well, I mean, I've been following your channel for about 2.5 years now, and I've always found you to be insightful and kind of poetic in the way you speak, and you're a good interviewer, so it's a treat for me to be here, and thanks for having me. As far as introducing myself, I mean,
thanks very much.
Yep. I mean, as far as myself, I mean, I'm a lifelong resident of New York City, both the greatest and the worst city in human history. And I've been red-pilled since I was maybe 12, 13 or so. I've appeared on a number of podcasts. I used to have my own podcast, mostly on TRS. I've done some live streams here and there. And I do caricatures of African-American friends of ours, and that's pretty much it. That's me.
Okay, all right. So you wanted to talk first about England, your experience of England.
Yeah, you know, I'm somewhat of an Anglophile, though I try not to be because I want to be able to accurately, you know, judge an individual's character. I find myself being a bit more, open to befriending, British people because of that. And perhaps I shouldn't. But I lived in England for a time. I also traveled to Scotland. And I guess all the aspects of Great Britain, from the red brick buildings to the rolling treeless hills, unlike the Appalachian mountains here, they're just blades of grass endlessly, and I think it's beautiful. The weather, the accents, the food, which is criminally underrated in my estimation. Yorkshire pudding and Cornish pasties are just about my favorite foods. Both of them, I would say, are probably my favorite foods. And everything sort of just fits together, comprising something like a character you're fond of in your favorite novel, perhaps. And when I was there, I actually had swine flu twice when I was there. And even then, when I was nearly bedridden, I was still having the time of my life. And I guess my memory of it is sort of somewhat colored by the weather, because when I was there, mostly in the summer and the late spring, the early fall, it hardly rained at all, and it was warmer than usual there. I mean, it barely ever rained, which is very unusual. And the whole time I was gone, New York City had like the rainiest summer it had ever had. So, and I've always had luck with the weather whenever I travel. But yeah, I'm quite fond of Great Britain. I know if I moved there and married one of your women, had kids, it would result in an abomination of mixed ethnicities, but I would consider it, frankly. I'll probably end up staying in America, but if I had to choose another place to live, it would definitely be Great Britain. So,
yes, yeah, it's funny that you talk favorably about the food, because obviously Britain is famous for, everyone loves to say how bad British food is. I mean, I don't think it's that bad. I think it's more that it's not. Brits don't tend to spend a lot of time on food. It's like a sort of necessity that we have to get over. We have to deal with it. But it's not something that we necessarily have historically taken pleasure in, like the French and the Germans, and definitely the Italians have. So, that doesn't mean that we eat crap food. It's just basic. It's very simple food, I think.
It's
one of those.
No, go ahead, sir. Oh, it's not as bad as the Irish, who say just throw a bunch of roots and stuff in a pot and boil it. I mean, some of English food you could consider to be slop, but as I said, I mean, Yorkshire pudding, how could you not like that? It's delicious, and there aren't the same artistic flourishes that you would see in French or Italian food, but it's all hearty and good, and I tend to be I like my salty, meaty food, so. I'm a fan.
Whereabouts are you in England? If it's probably safe for you to say the rough area.
I traveled all around, but I was living in London. Although I did take opportunities to visit, Amsterdam and France and so forth. So.
Right, I see. And how, I don't know if this is an appropriate question to ask or not, because I don't know anything about swine flu, but how did you get it? How did you get it twice? I don't know anything about it.
Well, you would get it like you would get a normal cold or a flu. You know, if you've ever been in the London Underground, it's very easy to, pick up.
Just misfortune then. Right. Okay. I have no idea what it is. I've heard of it, obviously. I don't know anything about it.
It was a really bad flu that went around at the end of the last decade of the aughts.
Right. Okay. Yeah, but I'm glad that you liked your time in England, because it is I have tremendous affection for Britain and England specifically as well. And the landscape, of course, is something that, after I left Britain, I definitely missed the landscape, the climate very much. It's something that is just sort of in... It's definitely something I grew up with, so it's very personal to me. But I think it's also something that people visiting for the first time are quite struck by it, especially if you go into the rural areas, like mountainous regions and so on, where you're in the middle of nowhere. The landscape of Britain can be very soulful, I think.
Sure. It manages to be sort of surreal, but comfortable and not over the top, perhaps, at the same time. Whereas in America, you have almost entirely wooded areas in the eastern third, other than the cities. And then in the middle third, you have this giant plain that stretches on forever. And really, most of the beauty in the United States is in the western third, the Rockies and the Pacific Coast, and the absolutely, I don't know if you've been there, but the desert in the southwest is just amazing and primordial and unlike anything on earth. But the eastern two-thirds of the country is kind of, I guess you could say, somewhat bland, although there are beautiful parts. England is more consistent throughout. And it's sort of, like I said, like a character, the landscape fits throughout the British Isles in general, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, regarding America, no, I didn't see the desert. I was there in San Francisco just for a while in the Southwest, but that was it. I was always in the cities, really, except for Maryland, where I was in a town, a small rural town, for a couple of days. And that was it. I mean, I do feel that the trip should have been longer. I originally wanted it to be 3 months. This is my trip 2 years ago, the Dangerous Haggis Tour, as I dubbed it. And I wanted it to be 3 months. That was my original idea, because I thought that would enable me to see more things and spend longer in each place and just be more leisurely. But that didn't happen in the end, which is a shame, because a month really wasn't long enough to see much. I saw the big cities of the West Coast and then some of the East Coast, and that was it, really. So there was the whole middle of America that I didn't see. It's a real shame.
Well,
and hopefully one day I'll come back and I'll spend longer there.
Yeah, well, come back to New York anytime. Speaking of New York, by the way, I have more non-regional accent at the moment, but I do have two accents, and my New York accent comes out, you know, when I'll go to the deli, you know, and get some coffee and some supersada, mozzarella, you know, that kind of thing. So I am a true New Yorker. Don't ban me for that, Spurg Chat.
You're the genuine article. And what is your sort of ancestry? Are you Italian or what? Well, obviously, I associate New York. I mean, I think most people from outside would associate New York with, well, Italians and another, is it safe to even mention them in connection with New York? Maybe it is, I don't know.
Our Levantine friends. No, I obviously I'm African American and Levantine. No, honestly, I'd rather not say. But most people assume I'm Italian based on when my accent comes out and my extreme fondness for Italians and Italian Americans. So, we'll just leave it at that. I'm a mutt. Let's just say.
Okay. All right then. So you wanted to talk about the movement in America and briefly, so that would be what has become well, has been known for several years as the alt-right, which, I mean, I have a complex relationship with that term and that movement. To me, when I first heard about it and was sort of introduced to it, it seemed very much something that was West-wide. And then quite soon after that, like for Britain and America and Europe and so on, but then quite soon after that, it became much more concentrated on America because of Trump. So the term alt-right came to be associated with the stuff that was happening in America. And I held on to it for a long time, and it still is there. I mean, it's still something that is, you know, there, present in Europe as well. But the term does seem to be falling out of use and out of favor as well, which is, I think, sad, but perhaps, I don't know, inevitable. I'm not sure. But so it does it. If nothing else, it refers to a moment in time, which was like late 2015 through to mid 2017. But I don't really want to say any more about that, because this is really about your feelings about it. So we're going to talk about the American movement. So go ahead.
Well, I'm sure some of my criticisms of the movement, I think could possibly be applied to Europe. I do see some of the same issues over there, although I think things are going really well in Europe right now. You might, the grass is always greener on the other side, but I think an outsider's perspective is often useful, and we could talk about that later. But as far as my criticisms, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind really is a lot of people repeat like falsehoods and don't seem to have, you know, they sort of have confirmation bias on a lot of things and don't, sometimes very intelligent people seem to lack the intellectual curiosity to just simply do like a 15-second Google search to confirm something. Like, people were saying that Heather Heyer died of a heart attack for the longest time when she had, you know, heart failure due to blunt force trauma, according to the coroner. And you know, people were saying she didn't get hit by the car, but if they were really interested in finding out, they could find out that she was in fact hit by the car. Other things people say that aren't true.
I have to say, mea culpa, I didn't know that. I did assume, because, and I'm guilty of exactly what you're saying here, because I heard that she was not hit by the car and that it was a heart attack. And so I just assumed, I think it was on Twitter at the time. And so I just assumed, okay, that's no one's disagreeing. No one's contesting that. So I'll assume it's the truth. And so, yeah, it's a sort of natural human laziness. I think I won't berate myself too much for it, but at this point, it does surprise me that a year on, I didn't know what you've just said. I'm so very surprised.
Well, I mean, being that you're not an American, not you know, as tied to things over here, I could understand why, you know, you yourself wouldn't research it. And look, I was guilty of that at first, at least for a couple of days. But eventually, I Googled it and, you know, looked up the coroner's report and everything. But you know, a year later, people are still seeing that. And also, like, think, you know, certain falsehoods are just convenient for people. Like, for example, people say that 3 million illegal aliens voted in the 2016 presidential election, which is ridiculous and totally untrue. And I could go into the demographic data on that and why that's a silly idea, but I don't want to take up too much time with that. And then there's also another one that really annoys me. People say that most of the slaves in America were owned by our Levantine friends, which is a demographic impossibility. It's just completely ridiculous. And the thing that annoys me about this sort of thing is that we have the facts on our side, so there's no reason to be fast and loose with them. I mean, there's just so many injustices and so many historical facts that we can reference that that buttress our arguments and our position. And I just wish people would not just repeat everything they heard.
Because, of course, it leaves them vulnerable to someone saying, oh, you obviously don't know the truth, because here's the truth. So you didn't know it, so you're an idiot. And so we don't need to take seriously anything that you say. That's the vulnerability if you get this stuff wrong. I mean, it's another one actually that occurred, in fact, there are two, but I'll just mention one, is that one of the myths that is, you know, you hear it all the time, is that the Holodomor was caused by Jews in the Soviet Union. But if you, I looked this up, I was curious about it. And actually there are six men, associated with causing it. And only, I think, one of them was Jewish. So it's like, okay, this is just annoying. You know, it's like, why are we saying something that can easily be disproven and thus making ourselves vulnerable to this, to the charge of just being, you know, idiotic?
The other issue is if just normal people that we try to convert, even if they don't fact check these things, if you say a lot of things, like particularly if all the slaves in America were owned by Jews, people are, if you say enough things like that, people are going to be like, all right, this person is out there. Whereas if you just reference, you know, historical facts about the, you know, about the founding of America, or you talk about the conditions for white students on campuses these days and all these things that are just obvious truths and almost like common knowledge, whether people admit it or not, you sound a lot more reasonable. And you can, you know, talk about more personal things that affect people and pull on their heartstrings. So yeah, I guess I don't really have much more to say on that, but, sort of related, a lot of people get lost in like conspiracy theory type thinking. And I think like there were people in the movement who after the Pittsburgh shooting or the mail bomber thing that preceded it right before, a lot of people reacted by saying things like, oh, how convenient it happened right before the election. And, you know, things like that happen. And they always have throughout history. And I just don't like the conspiracy theory type of mindset. I mean, there are tons of backroom deals and people conspire and you can show evidence of that. But stuff like this, just speculative stuff like that just kind of annoys me. And it does turn off normal people. And even if it's, you know, in private conversations, we talk to ourselves about those things, fine. But publicly, I just think it just doesn't come off well, frankly.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I mean, I have said one similar thing, which was about the killing of Joe Cox just immediately prior to the Brexit referendum, because frankly, I do have suspicions. It's just statistically improbable that that would happen right before that. I mean, I don't know. I think so. I think it's statistically improbable. I'm not saying it's impossible or whatever, but it's very rare for a politician to be killed in Britain. And the fact that it happened right before this referendum and the fact that her birthday was literally the day before the referendum, so as to bring it back into the public consciousness and tug on the heartstrings again. Yeah, that's kind of weird to me. And I have never said, therefore, she was obviously this was some kind of government psyop or it was set up by them somehow. All I'm saying is it wouldn't surprise me if it were. That's all I've said.
Well, this is similar to the Pittsburgh shooting mail bomber. I think when there's an election campaign going on, like there was earlier this fall and in the summer, the news cycle is more intense, and that's more likely to trigger people who are kind of nutty. And I'm not eliminating the possibility of conspiracies, but at the very least, I think expressing that publicly isn't the best idea.
I think you're right, because again, it does leave us vulnerable to the charge of being conspiracy kooks.
Mm-hmm. There are things that I have been critical about the movement that have seemed to be improving lately, like the idea that Trump can get hardly anything done. I think is laughable at this point, and frankly, I almost think we should mock people who go on and on about it. Now, there are people who do very good analysis of what's going on. It's important to know what's going on, and I think you can use kind of Trump to red pill normies, not just because of his rhetoric, but you can point out why he's not able to get done what the people elected him for. And there's a lot of people doing great work on that. And I'm certainly not singling out anyone in particular, because most of the major voices in the American alt-right were kind of like talking a lot about what Trump could get done, almost all of them. So I'm certainly not singling anybody out. But I mean, the first thought that was in my head November 10th, 2016, 2 days after the election or a day and a half after, because I mean, we had this incredible, amazing party here in New York, which was just probably the best night of my life. I woke up the next day at like 8 p.m. I called out of work and went on a little live stream real quick, went back to sleep. The very first thought I woke up and the first thought in my head is that the judiciary in particular, also the bureaucracy will leak things and hamstring him, and the cucks in Congress, if you will will sort of cock block him, but particularly the judiciary will block 90% of what he wanted to do. And I sort of, I talked about it a bit, but it didn't seem like people wanted to hear it at the time. And I'm not going to pat myself on the back of it, because there were times or spells, you could say, where I was like, all right, well, maybe Trump will do this and maybe Trump will do that. But at this point, I think it's time to let that go. And almost everybody recently since the election seems to have been doing that. And so I think that's heading in a positive direction. Another thing that I see as a positivity, people stopped making fun of the Proud Boys, and people have been willing to talk to people on the periphery, like Roosh, for example. And I think that's really a very positive thing. So I think that, you know, a lot of the criticisms I did have in recent months and in the past year and a half or so, seem to have been turning around now. And again, I'll say I was guilty of some of these things myself. So I'm not, you know, trying to point to myself as some sort of siren or amazing prognosticator or anything like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm in the same position, really. You know, I'm exactly the same position. I've got criticisms to make, but I have to confess that I am also guilty of these things myself. At least in the past, I've said things that I would not say now, just because I don't mean them. Basically, it's like saying things that are in too simplistic a manner for humorous effect. But of course, you know that our enemies will use that against us. Things like that. That's the kind of mistake that I've made, and I think a lot of people have made that mistake in the movement. Because in 2016, we were being deliberately over the top, and, you know, cartoonish about some things because it was a laugh. I mean, that was the thing. It just was hilarious at the time. But I think that since then we've paid a price for that in various ways.
I think that same 2016 mindset was what caused us to like attack the Proud Boys or Roosh V and be kind of Puritans, ideological Puritans. But I mean, I think not just some of us, but all of us were guilty of having bad sound bites. And I think you can minimize that, but you can't eliminate that. And also, as far as like knowing what's going to happen in the future or knowing if something is a bad strategy, none of us are oracles. None of us are soothsayers. So again, I'd like to reiterate that, you know, this is not, you know, me pointing at myself as some sort of, some sort of oracle or anything. That's obviously not the case. So.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Are there other criticisms of the movement or any concerns that you have about it?
Again, I think one of the major ones was, obviously there's infighting, and I don't want to get into drama, but I think the biggest one was the whole Trump thing. And a lot of people on the periphery, more of the kind of like snide people that I, you know, that are like American nationalist types or people who just troll constantly are still on that. And I think in the future, they're going to be proven to have erred in focusing so much on Trump and what he can get done. And now I think discussing Trump is important, and Trump being in office, first of all, kind of holds off whatever the next president is going to do. That's going to be terrible. And also just the cultural aspect of Trump running his mouth and using the betrayals by the judiciary and by the bureaucrats and by the Republicans in Congress to red pill normies, if you will, or people on the periphery is great. And I think I hope that the people who many of the people on YouTube and on podcasts who delve into those issues will continue doing that, because that's absolutely vital. My criticism was more in the speculation about what he can achieve, you know, in terms of policy. So, and that seems the American alt right seems to be moving away from that. And look, we're our best when we're on the attack. And so we kind of had to have a bit of a reckoning with all the demonstrations that happened in 27 and the failures of the Trump administration. And so I think, you know, we're going to head into new territory and a new phase, and it's going to be, it's going to bear a lot of fruit. So, but we have to learn, yeah. We have to keep in mind our failures.
Would you say that people had too unrealistic expectations of Trump? Sounds like that's what you are saying.
I do, yeah, certainly, without a doubt.
Do you think that if he had surrounded himself with other people, with better advisors, assistants, and so on, perhaps he would have achieved more, and those expectations wouldn't have been unrealistic then?
I think it would have drew us closer to the day when the Republicans are no longer this kind of holding pattern party that kind of keeps whites in a drug stupor. By having an administration staffed with populists and nationalists, there would be a dichotomy on the right that people would see, and people would probably then less associate the right with, you know, deregulation and tax cuts and blah, 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 blah. But as to what he could get done, I mean, the judiciary was always going to block him. And the idea that Justices Roberts, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh are going to save the white race by rubber stamping Trump's executive orders is laughable. Legislatively, I mean, look, the Republicans in Congress aren't going to see the election results as like, oh, we should have been more Trumpist. They're going to want to chase the donor money that the Democrats, they're going to want to win back the donor money that the Democrats got, I think, 2 or 3 to 1 compared to the Republicans in the last election cycle. No matter what branch of the government you look at, and then, of course, the bureaucrats that staff all the administrations that come under the purview of the president are all full of establishment types. So I think perhaps it would have accelerated an awakening among people if he had staffed his administration better, but I don't know what he would have been able to get done, frankly. It's tough to say.
Mm. So dare I ask, what do you think about the prospects for an internet bill of rights?
Not going to happen. I don't think so. Maybe perhaps in the perhaps far in the future, I don't know, maybe if there's a paradigm shift within the population, you know, culturally and an awakening of people, maybe. But otherwise, no.
You think that Americans, see from outside, one of the defining characteristics of America is freedom and or a belief in freedom. Maybe it's not always a reality, but there's America is associated with, you know, the concept of individual liberty, and of course that's epitomized by the First Amendment. So I would have thought, as an outsider, that it would be pretty easy to get the American public on side with a bill that would secure free speech, the First Amendment, on the internet.
Well, I mean, how tuned in are people to politics? You know, we work longer hours than pretty much all of Europe. And then there's the individualist streak that we tend to have, and the kind of hypnosis of the entertainment industry and everything. And, you know, in hard times, people might pay attention more and demand things. And it might sound in a poll, people will overwhelmingly support it, sure. But I mean, again, it relies on people staying in tune over a period of time with the, you know, despite the 24-hour news cycle, and you know, with the Republicans and the Democrats and Republicans being paid by donors not to pass a bill like that, and then Silicon Valley restricting access to information and ideas online, so people would actually learn more about it. I don't see it happening. Although, in a poll or on a referendum or a ballot measure, yeah, people would support it, but that's not going to happen, unfortunately, at least anytime soon.
Oh, that's very disappointing to hear. Very Sorry. Disappointing.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's if it's the reality, then we have to deal with it. I mean, we have to be completely prepared as we can be for the prospect of, you know, losing all of the freedom on social media that we've come to enjoy, whether that's our Twitter accounts or, well, I mean, I know that you get banned on Twitter. You've been banned quite a few times. I obviously lost my Twitter account 2 months ago, but then there's YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, everything really.
Well, as far as Twitter goes, over 2 years ago, I got into an argument with a New York Times journalist, and they started a campaign to have me banned. So I'm like super, super blacklisted on Twitter. I've given up at this point. I tried twice recently, and just no matter what I do, I can't stay on there. But as far as the internet, remember, the internet is very amorphous, and you can always find a way in somehow. Even if it causes frustration, and surely not being able to raise funds and stuff like that is a serious problem, but we'll find our way, and it's exhausting, but we'll find our way, and we'll stay relevant online one way or the other. You know, so we took them by surprise, and now they're clamping down, but you know, we're not out of the game online. We just have to keep pushing tirelessly. Mm-hmm. So.
And adapt and get ever more smart. So, okay, the other topic you wanted to talk about was Europe. Well, the penultimate topic is Europe and America comparison. One of the things that what we were just talking about links into that, because of course we don't have a First Amendment anywhere in Europe, and it is very annoying indeed. So I think that's one of the things that really changes. It's one of the big differences. It creates the lack of the First Amendment in Europe means that Europeans cannot quite understand what Americans are dealing with, and vice versa, because it changes the situation so much. What would you say about this?
Well, I think Silicon Valley has done sort of an end run around the First Amendment anyway. And yeah, you could get thrown in jail in Europe for speaking your mind, but there's, I think to some extent, there's less likely to be like if you get caught on video saying something mean to a person of color, I think there's less of a likelihood in Europe that you'll, you know, be put, you know, be memed by the left on every social platform and then get fired and so forth. And the social shaming, it's like one way or the other, our enemies are going to find a way to attack us. And I'm not going to diminish the, you know, the threats that Europeans face. It's certainly the muzzling that goes on there via like hate speech laws is awful. And, I've never experienced that. Although I did run my mouth on racial issues while I was in Europe, but I just assumed as an American, worst comes to worst, I'll just complain to the consulate and they'll be like, all right, let's just let this guy out of the country. Maybe we'll ban him or something. But yeah, I mean, our enemies find a way to attack people and shut people up. So the loss of a job and social shame. And of course, the racial issue has been in play in America much longer than in Europe. So, I mean, it kind of snuck up on you guys. And of course, the ideas that promoted multiculturalism and mass migration were sort of incubated here in America and then brought across the pond. And it kind of shocked you guys and snuck up on you. Whereas in America, the, you know, going back quite a long time, even before the 60s, there was just a ramping up of this social shaming and kind of people getting people to let go more and more and bits by bits of their identity and their ability to talk about their concerns about diversity and you know, wanting to live in a white community and so forth. But I would like to say that as far as the European American dichotomy or interplay or cooperation, one of the things that got me spurred, that kind of spurred my interest in the alt-right after having been fully red-pilled for so many years prior to its emergence, was seeing how concerned Europeans and Americans in the movement were for each other. You know, it was heartening to see, you know, Germans sharing Trump memes, Aussies posting videos of Farage chiding his fellow MEPs, European Parliament, or Americans using Orban avatars and so forth. Everyone's celebrating our shared history and our heroes. It was really a great thing. But we're in two very different positions. And if you don't mind, I can maybe go on a rant about Europe and how I see things as an outsider. Maybe that could be useful to people over there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not interjecting because there are some things I could have said. Just let me say one thing before you go on onto that topic. What you were saying about how these ideas were incubated in America and then sort of quickly transplanted over to Europe. There's an even sort of quicker example of this, which is the case of Ireland, because I think in that case, Ireland had largely escaped mass immigration and multiculturalism and everything long after other countries had, including England and even Scotland. But then, and so by the time it started in Ireland, the techniques of propaganda and the thought patterns that they wanted to encourage had been really refined to a great degree, and also the campaigning tactics and so on had really been refined for a long time, including in the European context, including in the British context, such that when this all started in Ireland, the Irish were basically subjected to a perfect formula for manipulation.
Absolutely.
So I don't think they stood a chance. I mean, this is why you've now got Irish women crying with joy about the ability to abort their babies. They have been expertly twisted and manipulated. And it is the result, it's the end result of decades of learning how to manipulate people into the pause and into multiculturalism and everything that we could name. And I think so in the case of Ireland, it's changed very, very fast. It's radically transformed the country in the space of like 20 years or even less than that. I mean, it's really very, very fast. And that was able to happen because of all this preparation work that was done in other European countries and before that in America in the first place. So that's a sort of mini but also hyper example of this, the thing that you're talking about. So that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, I think Ireland is an excellent case study. I never really thought about that before. And the techniques they honed over here, I mean, it took, you know, it's been a century and a half, I would say, or even longer that they've been, you know, honing these techniques here in America. I will say, that of course, well, it's very they're very disingenuous, our enemies, because they took the America as a proposition nation, which it, you know, was in a limited sense for Europeans, but it was never, you know, meant to be applied to, you know, people of any abstraction from anywhere in the world. Well, they took that and they planted that onto, you know, overlaid that on top of Europe, and it's, you know, they'll point to, oh, well, you know, the Romans brought a maid from Morocco to Great Britain in the second century. So that means, you know, Europe was, Britain was always
always multicultural. Britain was also always multiracial, always multicultural. It was a nation of immigrants. And what was the other one? There's another thing that they say. I've forgotten. There was a fourth one that was on my mind there, but the same talking points that were devised in the first place for America and make a kind of sense in America, but don't make any sense in Britain or other European countries, and yet they're just transplanted wholesale onto those other countries because I don't know why. It's that maybe it's like a Pavlovian thing that we've been trained to accept hearing these things said, regardless of where they're said about. So it's kind of totally irrational. But yeah, and it's the same things with like diversity is a strength. Diversity is our greatest strength. Race doesn't exist. Our differences must be celebrated, including our racial ones, even though that contradicts the previous thing, and so forth and so on. So we've heard all these things said about America within America. Now they're over here. And in the case of that's just on the racial angle. You could go on about gay, trans, feminism, abortion, whatever, religion, atheism, etc. In the case of Ireland, the sort of reason I brought that up is the speed of it, but also you've got to remember it goes from basically a heavily religious country to a heavily paused country within about 20 years.
Well, the reason it works
is remarkable.
The reason it works is because our enemies control the major institutions, and if they just repeat all of these things like a litany, you know, it has a tremendous effect. And then also, you know, people could always talk about colonialism in the way they could talk about America. You know, they could always guilt trip people with colonialism, just like they could with slavery.
That's another one
in America. And the thing is, what they say about, you know, anybody can be an American. First of all, if anybody can be can be an American, then it doesn't mean anything to be an American. So, I mean, what they said never fit over here, but there were certain historical avenues that they could then warp to kind of make it seem like it might kind of make sense, you know, if they pump the narrative enough. But it makes absolutely no sense in Europe, but it still works anyway. But I will say that it's working less and less, and I think Europe is in a really good place right now. And if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, definitely. Let's go into that now. I'll leave you to speak for a few minutes. I won't interrupt.
Well, first of all, you know, I look at the EU as sort of this labyrinthine supranational block that has sort of developed into an entity that intends to and is utilized to not only quash both national identity and sovereignty, but also erode European identity as well, sort of redefining what it means to be a European, like we were just talking about. And it has mechanisms in play, you know, a range of institutions and bureaucracies that have and will continue to be used for that purpose. You know, the European Commission, the European Council, the Council of the European Union, which most people don't know that those last two things are different things. There's the Court of Justice, the Human Rights Commissions, the Central Bank, the auditors, and on and on. And then there are all the agreements that have been ratified and all the charters that result in, you know, permanent status for migrants and so forth. And furthermore, the EU has given wide a latitude to a lot of NGOs that coax and sort of morally preen, even down to the municipal level, people into accepting an endless stream of foreigners. But the thing is, you know, the EU is just kind of fake. You know, it's just so artificial, unlike the American Republic that spans, you know, much of the North American continent. And it's all these sort of tripwires that are set up to sort of, like I said, quash national identity and even European identity. They're all sort of artificial, and I think they kind of overstep their bounds. You know, more than 2 years ago, I predicted that Italy would be the first Western European country to elect a nationalist populist government, and that this would be the first domino to fall. And so I think we've actually already won in Europe, and now we're simply going to see events unfold in our favor. And indeed, a lot of very powerful people that are involved with activism in NGOs and academia are sort of pulling resources out of Europe to focus on America. I mean, simply compare Emmanuel Macron with Matteo Salvini. You know, Salvini is the face of the new ruling coalition and truly Italy's most powerful player, despite the fact that he's not the prime minister, he's the interior minister. Macron is facing an uprising of sort of normal middle-class Frenchmen and has a 20-something percent approval rating. Salvini, on the other hand, is beloved by the people. His approval rating is somewhere around 80%. And he's actually been effective. Like, unlike Trump, he has cut migration by 90%. And he goes out there and physically helps, like, government workers that are tearing down migrant and Roma squatter camps. And he has, you know, said that he wants to arm the people and he wants to expel 500,000 people. And I think he may very well be successful in that. And even just trying to do that, he'll spit in the face of the EU and that will accelerate things. You know, in the first half of the 20th century, we saw the far right rise first in Italy, and I think it will be much the same this century. And this is not a flash in the pan because, I mean, the variables and the conditions involved in what we're seeing will continue to intensify. And I also must say that I have a deep affection for Italians. Perhaps this biases me. The beautiful, whimsical or musical quality of the language, the sultry or fiery appeal of their women, and Italians in general just have moxie, as we as Americans would say. And of course, the food, the landscape of Italy and so forth.
What does moxie mean?
Moxie is just like being daring and maybe being somebody with moxie would be daring and blunt with their words and not afraid to just be who they are and say what they think and challenge power. So, but yeah, the Italians definitely have it. So molto bella Italia, I'll say. So I think things are going very well in Europe, frankly.
I am very optimistic about Italy. It gives you a good feeling just to think about Italy just now. But what about other countries in Europe, though? I mean, where else are you optimistic about? Well, where else gives you optimism, maybe I should say?
I know it's, you know, the Chemnitz protests in Germany. I think Germany is sort of the most psychologically occupied country in the West, and it's also somewhat physically occupied by, you know, the American military and of course, you know, globalist, you know, globalism, the institutions, activism, academia, and then also sort of like global Western fake kind of artificial culture. But the fact that the Chemnitz protests happened is amazing. And then I think what's happening with the yellow vests in France is really incredible. And I think also Sweden, I think, is potentially the next domino to fall as well. You know, they're also very, you know, they're very far along in the process of our enemies are very far along in the process of what they're trying to do there. But of course, I just think they're overreaching. And I just think you just see the parties, these far right parties, these nationalist parties, these populist parties are just rising, and much for a more consistent time period, you know, more consistently and ongoing, they continue to rise. And despite the hate speech laws and everything and all the impediments, like it's just a growing force. You know, our ideas are penetrating further and further, and we're, you know, making gains. And this is what's reported to me by a lot of my friends in Europe. And it's such a stark contrast to what I saw when I was there in the aughts. So I think it's tough to say what country will be next, but I think it's inevitable, and the ball is already rolling, and it's not going to stop rolling. In my mind,
I definitely agree with that. I think that there will be obstacles, and things will sometimes slow down and sometimes speed up. But I think the process is underway now, and I don't think there is any stopping it now. Actually.
Tougher to say that for America, I would say. If you want to go, you know, to compare the two, if you want to talk about America in comparison. Yeah,
let's do that.
Well, I mean, I think it's true that America from its founding had, you know, like attributes that are impeding our progress to this day. You know, the founders were largely Puritans with, you know, a lot of mercantile interests and silly ideas such as, you know, thinking man is inherently rational and so forth. Like one of your guests earlier today seems to believe. Also, I mean, Americans are sort of selected for individualism and a lack of rootedness, not being attached to their sort of geographic surroundings, given that most of our ancestors came here in seek of just a better standard of living or to flee religious or political persecution. So there's a strong argument to make that the problems we're facing here in America were sort of baked into the cake, so to speak. However, there are a lot of near permanent attributes that America has and have and will continue to be useful for us. I mean, for one, the founders were essentially white nationalists, given the one of the first acts of Congress limited naturalization to, you know, I think the quote is whites of good character. And then also the First and Second Amendment to the Constitution protect our speech and our right to bear arms. And I think we'll continue to for a good amount of time. And I think if they go after them, that will really, our enemies go after that, that will certainly spark something. Secondly, there are some people in our movement that argue that America doesn't have a culture. And it's true that American culture is more sort of amorphous than those of our European brothers, as nations. And it's true that our culture has been hijacked sort of to be nothing but consumerism and fast food and what types of media and entertainment we consume seem to define us. But there is undoubtedly an authentic American culture, and white identity is intrinsically linked to that culture. I think of Manifest Destiny. You know, one of my favorite paintings is titled American Progress by John Gast. This is from the 1870s, I think. It shows Lady Liberty laying a telegraph wire as she strides across the Great Plains of the continent. And at the same time, settlers are sort of like traversing the Oregon Trail in wagons. Homesteaders are plowing their newly found home on the prairie, and prospectors are hunting bears on their way to California in hopes of striking gold. And on the far right of the painting, you see the great city of New York with the Brooklyn Bridge and the harbor. And on the extreme left, you see Buffalo and the natives fleeing from this giant Lady Liberty. It's like, you know, striding across the land. And, you know, other things that invoke the culture of America, you know, the pictures of skyscrapers that seemingly hang from the sky, you know, being constructed by white men. I think of, sorry to reference sports ball, but baseball, this pastoral game that's passed on from father to son, you know, a game that was once so popular and so ubiquitous from the Atlantic to the Pacific that nearly every local church had their own baseball team. Likewise, the patrons of every local bar would have their own team as well. And the church and the people from the church and the guys from the bar would play each other on Sundays after services let out. And that is a uniquely American thing. And, you know, I think when I think of America, I also think of white men responding to, you know, brutal attacks by natives, despite what, you know, your professor will tell you. Most of the violence in the early settling of America was sparked by very brutal attacks by natives. I also think of fighting Mexico to secure our geographic security. I mean, think about the Declaration of Independence, which is essentially a list of grievances directed at King George III, I believe it was. And the final grievance, and you would assume that you'd save the most impactful grievance for the end of the list, is as follows, and I'll quote it for you. I have the page pulled up here. "He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." So from the very beginning, white people were circling the wagons to protect themselves and their families and their civilization. And the idea that white Americans are inherently less connected to that, their identity, than Europeans, I think to some extent it might be true, but there's certainly a very strong identity there, and it might not be ethnic, but it is racial, undoubtedly. And if you don't believe me, Google the Rock Springs Massacre of, I believe it was 1885, or the Tulsa Race Riots of 1921. None of those, that kind of thing that I would endorse, but it does show you how fiercely whites defended their identity. So
I think it's a very difficult thing to characterize, because, well, especially for me as an outsider, and I don't know much about this, but I think that with America, first of all, obviously there is the factor of different ethnic groups colliding together, but I don't actually think that's as big a problem as it, I don't think that needs to be a big problem, because it seems to me that America, let's say 100 years ago, white America did have a culture and a very solid identity of its own. At the same time as there were groups like Germans who were still speaking German at that point before the First World War. there were towns, I believe, where the ancestral cultures were still very much there, or at least they were still behaving as if they were still there. And so that was going on, but at the same time, there does seem to have been a very solid American identity. And it seems that actually the 20th century is what has weakened that. That's how it seems. That, like, actually consumer culture has taken Americans away from what was there before. Now, you could put it another way and say Hollywood culture has taken over America in the last 100 years and has detached white Americans from what their ancestors created and who their ancestors were. Obviously, that takes us into dangerous territory. But yes. You know what I mean. So yes. It's someone once said there has never been a white Hollywood, because from the start it was Levantine in its nature. So we've never actually had an American film industry per se. It's been a different type of film industry. Now, that's a very strange thing to think, because of course we associate Hollywood with America, and American film equals Hollywood, and that's it. There's no There's nothing else. There's nothing but Hollywood. that's one thing. But also, the other part of it is that the other sort of question I would raise is that obviously white America, well, those were pioneers. And eventually you have to stop pioneering because there's nothing left to pioneer. You've now got a comfortable suburbia. And at that point, you know, what is there to hold you together? Especially when what replaces the struggle and toil is the comfort of consumerism. At that point, it's very easy just to collapse into that. And that's exactly what seems to have happened. As for the question of what the result is, I don't like it when people, I especially don't like it when Europeans make fun of Americans and are very simplistic about it and say that there's no such thing as American culture. I think that is just simply untrue. It's simply nonsense. I don't know how many of them actually mean it seriously when they say it. A lot of them might be bants. I'm not sure. But whether the culture is as deep as European cultures is another question. And I'm not qualified to answer that.
It might not be quite as deep as like ethnic identity, but in a way it's more wide, if you will. So, you know, in some ways it doesn't have as much foundational strength, but in some ways it does. And I think what drove white identity in America was necessity. And I think that's what's going to awaken it again. And I think a lot of what's going to lead to eventual victory in Europe and perhaps in America will be our enemies doing our work for us and making, you know, conditions difficult for whites. And even if we don't have economic hard times, just physically not being able to move another, you know, exit down the highway and the ramping up of like anti-white rhetoric is going to really reawaken white identity, hopefully, in America. And to touch on what you had just said about America, Europeans bouncing America, and we had discussed before how a lot of ideas that academics in America developed. Remember that the Frankfurt School was the Frankfurt School for a reason. It transplanted itself from Germany to, I think it was City College, or I believe it was City College in Manhattan. And so there's kind of like cross-Germanization, if you will, back and forth across the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing because you associate the Frankfurt School and the whole American hippy-dippy thing with America, and it's like very much a cutting-edge 20th century thing. But actually, they were from Germany. It's a very surprising fact about it. Like Herbert Marcuse, who came up with the phrase "make love, not war," was actually, where was he from? Let me Google this before I say something stupid. But I believe he was German. Yeah. That is kind of surprising because you see, it seems very 20th century, very post-war, very second half of the 20th century. But actually, they came from, old Europe.
Well, remember, I mean, when the civil rights legislation and the desegregation of schools and the hippie movement was happening in America at the very same time, decolonization and student protests were happening in Europe too. So again, it's sometimes they can be, it's not entirely something that was transplanted from Europe, from America to Europe. I will say, it's true that the demographics are worse than in Europe here, but I think people need to remember that America is incredibly important for the white race as a whole. And it's not simply, you know, if not simply due to its near sublime, near perfect geography. This is something I tend to spurg about. You know, the United States has more prime arable land than any country on earth. There's nothing close to an equal to the Great Plains anywhere in the world, to say nothing of California's Central Valley or the Atlantic Plain or the lush green valleys between the soft rolling, you know, mountains of Appalachia. I mean, this country has more navigable rivers than the rest of the world combined. I don't know if many people don't know that. And that those rivers are perfectly overlaid on top of the Great Plains that I mentioned previously. And we have ports on both the Atlantic and the Pacific, We have three of the four best natural harbors in the world, San Francisco Bay, Puget Sound, and the Chesapeake. And the only equal to that is Sydney's harbor in Australia. And on top of that, you know, we just have so many natural resources, rare metals and fossil fuels. And these resources have been used to create and then buttress a global system that works against our interests, including in Europe. And I think it is the duty of the alt-right or the dissident right or the far right in America to turn that around. And that's not to say that we have to win in America to win in Europe. But if we don't win here, we will see institutional power here in the United States brought to bear on Europe, used to try and put the genie back in the bottle in Europe. You know, the military power with NATO stationing troops over there, economic power, you know, trade wars, tariffs, boycotts, cultural power, Hollywood, the music industry. And maybe most importantly, you know, consider the fact that, as we said before, most of the academic theories used to sort of muzzle Europeans and most of the biggest NGOs and the funding for them, which are used to enforce, you know, refugee resettlement, for example, have their origins in America. So it's really important that we win here. And I think to do that, and I'm sort of counter-signaling certain people in the movement, you know, I don't do that. I'm not trying to attack anybody, but, you know, abandoning white American identity, I'll say, the idea that we have to abandon it to win, I disagree with. And it's true that in some ways, American identity is lost and something will have to rise from the ashes if we're to win. But using American identity will bear fruit regardless, because if you reinforce what I said before about manifest destiny in American culture, it will make people angry as a result of the sense of loss from that and allow us to build something new. And another thing that gives me hope is that America has, you know, sort of proven that white identity and not just ethnic identity among various whites is a real thing and a powerful thing. And if you'll allow me to give an example, many of the old Italian neighborhoods here in New York City have seen an influx of Russians in recent decades. Now, I personally am not overly fond of that presence in these neighborhoods because newly arrived Russians tend to be sort of gruff and surly and humorless, but their children always end up being sort of regular old white working class and middle class New Yorkers. Second generation Russians, third generation Italians, fourth generation Irish, 10th generation Anglos. They're all quite similar if they have similar geographic surroundings and economic statuses. I believe that our genetic differences aren't significant enough to give us significantly different temperaments, you know, if all
yes. I certainly agree with that. Certainly. Yeah. It's one of those things. It just isn't an issue. I actually think that white people mixing is something that they do remarkably easily. Depending on the situation, obviously. I'm not saying that white people just constantly love each other, but that's obviously not the case. But in an amenable situation, yes, they simply do. I think the only big barrier is between South and, like, if you've got Southern, like Mediterraneans and, you know, big Nordics, there can clearly is a difference of temperament there. But again, it's not one that's going to lead them to want to kill each other or something absurd like that.
Yeah, I mean, look, second-generation Americans in decades past would sort of be hazed by Americans from families that had deeper roots here, you know. And as a result, they perhaps would be compelled to integrate. Like, for example, I've heard stories from elder generations of my family about how they'd tell their parents, which would be like my great-grandparents or great-granduncles or whatever, look, you know, this is like the land of plenty. You can bathe more than twice a month, Dad, now. You know, now that we're here, you can afford a manicured lawn so we don't look like the weird family on the block and so forth. And it's, people want to be a part of a team, and being a part of Team White will eventually, again, be a great boon for our co-racialists in coming years. So I think that's one thing that Europeans can learn from Americans, in addition to our sort of ability to hijack culture. Due to that, we're more familiar with, like, you know, Hollywood and the music industry. But Americans also have a lot to learn about how to organize politically, like our brothers in Europe have shown capable of. And we also have to look to Europe also for our deeper roots and a deeper sense of identity to kind of destroy this everybody can be an American idea. So I think there's just so much we can learn from each other. And the banter's fine, but Yeah, there's just so much that we can learn from each other, as I said.
Yeah, I completely agree. And again, I think that's maybe something that could be a hangout on its own at some point to discuss what can we. I mean, it's a bit precious, perhaps. It might be a bit awkward, but I think it would be interesting to discuss what are the things that Americans can take from Europeans and from Europeans from Americans. That what lessons can be learned from this? I think that'd be quite profitable, actually, if it could be disciplined. So, because of course that's always the danger with discussions. All right. So, okay. So the final thing is, what can we do to win? So that was the final topic that we agreed on. So go for it.
Well, in my opinion, the first thing that we have to do, and it's very important, Greg Johnson and Richard Spencer have to do a karaoke duet of Erasure's "Oh L'Amour," or else there's no chance we can win. Joking, of course.
Well,
that would be hilarious.
No comment. No comment. Although I think maybe the one thing that we can all agree on is that, you know, that is Erasure's best song.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great track. I love effeminate 80s music.
Well, now that you've said that, it's rather embarrassing for me to admit that they are. And I do love Erasure. And I do love that. I love that song. It's a great song. But anyway, let's leave that aside for now. So go ahead.
Well, one of the things that has always kept me white-pilled, as we say, and remember, I've had these beliefs for about two decades now, ever since I was, you know, an adolescent, and I've always thought that we would win in the end, despite the fact that for most of the past two decades, things had gotten worse and worse, at least until 2015. I think the impact that we can have is somewhat limited, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think it's paradigm shifts. You know, historical events are really going to drive things. And my impression of what has led people to the alt-right is based on hundreds of personal and public interviews and conversations that I've had, where things like 9/11, the whole Trayvon Martin / Ferguson / BLM, and then Obama running his mouth about it thing, and then the migrant crisis, and then Trump deciding to run and using the rhetoric he used, and also the terrorist attacks in recent years, like that seemed to really happen frequently in 2015, 2016, like Charlie Hebdo, Nice, the Bataclan earlier in the decade. I mean, those were all things outside of our control. And they're terrible things. And I don't, you know, I'm not going to say I'm going to hope for more of those things, but it's just inevitable that more of those things will happen. At the same time, our enemies, if you will continue to push further and further with the anti-white rhetoric. And that is what has driven so many people into our arms. And I think more than anything, we have to give people a place to find safe harbor. And we have to sort of glom ourselves onto protests and movements and all sorts of things. We have to get involved in the conversation that people have as a result of these events unfolding. I think the yellow vest protests are a great example of that.
Yeah, definitely. This is where I would dare venture to say that there's too much individualism in Britain and in America, in the psyche, because I think it prevents us from just taking collective action. Just sort of getting together and doing it, getting a job done. I think, and again, the left this doesn't apply to them at all. They have plenty of collectivism. They have plenty of ability to just do something, and then, you know, the right are screwed. I think that, yeah, what you're saying there with the yellow jackets thing, absolutely, it's great, because it's clearly scared them, the establishments. It's clearly scared them. I actually read that Macron has apparently just introduced a law to raise the minimum wage, which is just clearly a way to placate the masses. I hope it doesn't work. I really hope it doesn't work. I hope they don't fall for that.
But
the point is that I think Americans and Brits could get a lot better at doing it. I mean, the thing is, obviously, I don't want to see the nature of the British be lost. And individualism is a key part of our psyche. But right now it's causing us to be, well, to die out. And I think the same is true of Americans.
Well, I think there's, you know, collectivism and individuality are not mutually exclusive. And it's sort of when we are a collective, that's when we're in a place where we can safely, our individualism can flourish and contribute to our societies. I think we sort of have to be less right wing in a way. First of all, I mean, obviously, here in America, getting away from this deregulation and more tax cuts thing is really important. But I mean, just outside of policy, I mean, you want to be right wing in the sense that you want structure and continuity and idyllic beauty and things like that. But something that's more associated with the left wing is sort of youthful rebelliousness. And when you combine those two things, you have near invincibility. That is an incredibly powerful thing when you merge those two things. And that's that.
Which two things, just for clarity, which two things?
Well, the sort of the right wing sort of desire for order and structure and continuity with the sort of left-wing youthful rebelliousness. And I think we're sort of in a sweet spot where the establishment is, you know, anti-white and anti-traditional. So actually being rebellious and using using the tactics that the left has used for so long to attack tradition and to attack order and idyllic beauty and tradition, is now rebelliousness. And that's a sweet spot that I think when the alt-right is at its best, that's what I guess you could say defines the alt-right at its best. And so I think we have to sort of be we have to have our feet on two kind of pieces of property at the same time. We have to kind of be striding, standing astride two different kind of mentalities at the same time, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I agree. Let me just go through the super chats in case there are any questions for you, because I don't want to miss them. Okay, somebody says you have real nice wit, but he says Maniba DeMarcus, real nice wit. He always got the freshest kicks, and then says something that I'm not sure if it's an insult or not, so I'm not going to read out on air. And then says, as fun and powerful as memes are, they have become a hindrance to individuals maturing. I think that was in relation to something you were saying earlier on, and I think that's kind of true. Briefly, what would you say about that? As fun and as powerful as memes are, they have become a hindrance to individuals maturing.
Well, I see a sort of dovetailing between people that meme so much and so constantly that they just seem just mischievous, and maybe perhaps they got into this more to. I mean, sure, they might agree with our ideas and stuff, but some people I think got into this with not entirely the best intentions, and they sort of just wanted to be mischievous. And I think at some point, I mean, our sense of humor certainly has propelled us along with other things. But I think we have to be somewhat measured in our approach with that. And we can't just be doing that all the time. And I think the people that do, I think, are sort of they're sort of missing something. And a lot of those people are the people that tend to cause the most problems. And the people that, interestingly enough, become the most nihilistic at the same time.
Yes, definitely. That's it. I was going to say that. I think it starts to sort of consume them, and nothing in the end, nothing matters. Everything's just sarcastic and a joke. And I mean, this is kind of connected with the it's only a meme bro or whatever, but it's not quite the same thing. I'm talking about people who, everything is nothing really matters. You know, it really is just all a joke to them, because that's the mentality that they've got into. And it's a shame. I think that people tend to get lost in memeing, I think. It really takes them over, some people, anyway. And as you say, they end up being a liability because they don't actually stand for anything. And crucially, when they see somebody who does stand for something, their first reaction is to dismantle him, you know, to discredit him in some way, because he's committing the cardinal sin of making himself vulnerable by believing in something, which is that's part of it. I think a lot of memeing, you know, when it gets to this addictive level, this pathological level, it really is a sort of it's a way to avoid ever being vulnerable, you know, because you don't actually have to stand for anything.
Well, I think a lot of the people who do that get in the habit. They got into the habit of being on the attack, and I guess maybe it's high time preference or something, but they didn't see the results that they wanted, let's say, from the Trump administration fast enough. And so they feel powerless as far as like real institutional change on, you know, a time scale that they're comfortable with. And so they have to go on the attack somewhere, and they're black-pilled or nihilistic. And so they find an obvious target to attack is the people that they feel betrayed them or let them down or lied to them, which I think is obviously unfair.
Yeah. Somebody's just posted a comment in the live chat that I think sort of sums up a lot of what we've been saying in this conversation, so I'll just read it out. We relied on poll back then. I think he's referring to 2015-16. Pure chaos. We've got to create order now, be organized, work together, and provide solutions. What do you say about that, DeMarcus?
I mean, I can't disagree, and despite what I said about, you know, historical events that will happen in the future driving us to victory, there's still plenty that we can do. And I think, you know, you sort of have to let a thousand flowers bloom. I mean, one aspect is the culture war, and that involves memes. And we could talk about that forever. One aspect is, you know, red pilling people and sort of tactics. Like, I think the left has sort of lexicographed, if you will, which is to redefine words. Words like judgmental, for example, you know, maybe I'm dating a girl and she has some degenerate ideas about things or whatever it is. And, you know, she'll be like, oh, don't judge. And I'm like, wait, do you have any friends in this world? And they'll be like, yeah. I was like, all right, then you've judged people. You've determined them to be somebody that is worth having in your life. So they've sort of turned... Being judgmental would be somebody who just constantly, you know, criticizes things, but they it's lexicographed to now just mean making judgments about people for, you know, the interests of whether it's yourself or your family or society as a whole. And so anytime you say something important about, hey, you should make a change in this, or we need to make a change in this, people just be like, oh, don't judge, or say like, oh, no regrets. And then there's the word tolerance. This one particularly annoys me, because if you were to ask somebody from 100 years ago, they would describe being tolerant as like there's a gnat buzzing in your ear, and you just, you know, you're sitting on your front porch in the summer, so there's just going to be gnats, so you just tolerate it. And that's turned into, you know, tolerating your cities turning into a slum and so forth. So it's important that we unravel that. And then, you know, as far as language, also the individualist, collectivist dichotomy, you know, we have to ask ourselves how we can overcome the anecdotes, you know, the, oh, I have a Muslim friend who would, you know, I don't know, dive into an erupting volcano to save my cat or something like that, you know. You know, the anecdotal evidence that normies use to avoid addressing the sort of aggregate effects of diversity and mass immigration, we have to make them come to grips with group dynamics. So like you have to be able to respond to people, maybe in a mocking way, in an emotional way, like, oh, I guess this, you know, one acquaintance from work is more important than your family and, you know, the history of your country and all the people that developed your culture, all your ancestors and all of that, all the people who have invented everything you use in modern life. Or, you know, you can, I guess, you realize that all other races and cultures agree with what I'm saying, and they're going to continue to and always have throughout time to have a sense of tribal identity. So it's just pointless. So if you invite all these people into your country, your country is going to end up being, you know, based on identity and collectivism anyway. So you might as well, there's no hope in that. So getting people to realize that is important. And I think the final thing that we can do is, I don't want to call it infiltration, but getting involved with, well, first of all, local politics. I don't think we're going to, you know, we should aim for being the governor of a state or a senator or the president. But local politics is very important. Also civic organizations. If you're in America and you're a Catholic, join the Knights of Columbus. If you have the kids, join the PTA. If you're a homeowner and there's a homeowners association, join it. If you're a veteran, join the American Legion or something like that. But, you know, as far as local politics, America and increasingly other Western countries sort of have, I guess you could say, empire-like conditions internally. I'm not talking about externally, like possessions outside of the borders of the country, but internally, you have a polyglot political entity, like an empire, and all empires fall. Nation states like France and Japan could potentially exist forever, but all empires fall. And if you look at many of the major conflicts in history, and some of them were even largely bloodless revolutions, you have a large central government that continues to centralize power. And they have eventually they have no idea. They don't have their pulse on their pulse on the senses of the people. And they don't know what's going on the provincial level. And local resistance, and I'm not even talking about violence, but just local efforts to stymie them, it sort of, you know, exhausts the ruling class and the structures they use to keep people in line. So get involved on a local level, and that'll reap tremendous benefits in the future.
Okay, I agree with that. There's nothing really that I want to add. I don't want to dilute what your words by just repeating them in my own way. Okay, so excellent. Let's leave it at that then. I think we've covered five topics in quite a full and enjoyable way. So, excellent. So, DeMarcus, is there anything else you'd like to say before we end?
Well, we've been going for quite some time. I'm sure you're exhausted. You put in a lot of work today. But I would like to make a final brief statement to sort of, if it perhaps lift people's spirits. And I hate to be cliche and use the Lord of the Rings analogy, but, I sort of had an epiphany once when I was very young, or I was in my teens, and the Lord of the Rings movies came out, and I read the books at the same time. And I remember looking at seeing the people and the elves and the humans and the little guys, whatever they're called, were fighting. They all looked the same, right? They all looked very similar. Whereas, you know, the eye color and the hair color of the humans and the elves and everything were all different. And when I look at the Rotherham suspects, I look at them and then I compare them to, say, like a pictures released of a Navy SEALs team from like the 1980s, because of course they don't reveal their pictures. Contemporary pictures of those guys. And I just see the difference, and it sort of reminds me of that. And then also what reminds me of the Lord of the Rings is, like, you have enemies within and without in this seemingly impossible struggle. But in a way, this story that we're immersed in right now is incredibly beautiful. And we're in the most pivotal moment in the history of our civilization. Even the invasions of the Persians and then all the sultanates of the Muslim conquests can't compare to what we're the importance of what we're facing right now. And I just think it just seems like destiny to me that we are to overcome this. And I think we can be proud to say that we were there at the beginning when the tide began to turn. And we have to remember not to be selfish, because what I know is that if whites get to the point that they're circling the wagons and a sense of white identity has taken hold, and remember, look at past revolutions, it only has to be like maybe, I don't know, somewhere between 50 to 30% of the population. I have to, you know, be very strongly on board with this, and the rest of the people that just tend to be followers. And we see this in other revolutions in the past. They will just be like, oh, that's the new thing that we're doing now. Oh, okay. And once the ball gets rolling on that, even if I'm an old man on my deathbed, I can you know, my consciousness can drift away from this reality, and I will have a smile on my face knowing that we've won, even if there's decades or a century of struggle to come. If once we get to that point and we're circling the wagons, we've already won. We just have a lot of work to do from that point. So all we have to do is get to that point. And I don't just believe, I believe with my mind, but I also reason, I believe with my heart, but I also reason with my mind that that will happen. I know it will happen. And that's all I wanted to say on that.
Okay. Demarcus Leibowitz, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2018.
Thanks for having me. It was a treat.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have enjoyed this one, so thank you for appearing. And okay, excellent. That's it for tonight. And I think this is a good one. I like that there's been this, because I don't often collaborate with people from America. So it's, yeah, I've enjoyed this. It's been quite unusual for me. Okay, let's leave it at that. Demarcus, thank you for appearing, and everyone at home, thank you for watching. And I will see you tomorrow for another 5 Hangouts. Good night.